Hi, and welcome to the Religion Bites podcast. I'm Mallory Nye, and this is episode 22. The theme for today's podcast is the decolonization of religious studies, looking at postcolonialism, decoloniality, and the cultural study of religion. Broadly, what I'm trying to do is to give a quick few reflections on what we mean by this seemingly new phrase of decolonialism or decolonizing, and see what that means or may potentially mean in the study of religion. But before I start, I thought I'd give you a quick reminder, if you don't know about it already, that I also have another podcast series called Histories, Inc. You can find details about this and a link through to it on my website for Religion Bites, which is at religionbites.xyz, and that's religionbites, all one word, .xyz. Also, you can find a written version of today's discussion in my blog on medium.com. Again, details of how to find that can be found on the Religion Bites website, .xyz, or you can simply Google Mallory Nye Religion Bites, possibly putting medium at the end if you can't find it through that. Also, I'd just like to give some thanks and a quick shout out to the School of Critical Studies at the University of Glasgow, where I'm currently teaching, whose sound studio I'm using to record this episode. Many thanks for these facilities. So, here are some fairly quick thoughts on the decolonization of religious studies. There can be no doubt that the academic study of religion emerged out of European colonialism. There are various lines of descent for the discipline, and like much of the humanities and social sciences, they all lead back to colonialism, and in particular the 19th and early 20th centuries. And so, during a time when there is a widespread movement for the decolonization of knowledge, what I'm asking, is there also a need, or is there a particular need, for a decolonization of the study of religion? And if so, what would that involve? Where do we start? Well, here are some initial exploratory thoughts on this major issue. The first question to ask is perhaps the most basic. What are we meaning? What are we trying to refer to by the term decolonization? And I think there are several issues that first need to be made clear when talking about this, when trying to understand and explain decolonization. The term decolonization is itself quite old, which references in particular the process at the end of European colonialism around the mid-20th century, when countries that had been subjected to British, French, Dutch, and other colonial rule became independent. Thus, we can talk of the decolonization of India, South Asia, and Southeast Asia, across much of Africa, the Caribbean, and so on. It was during this time that some of the important writers on decolonization emerged, such as Frantz Fanon and Albert Memmi. But the processes of decolonization didn't end with the withdrawal of empires and the creation of new nation-states, which most emerged with newly constructed borders from colonialism. Such immediate decolonization often had a harsh cost, such as the extreme violence deriving from British policies and mismanagement in India that spilled out in the first few months of independence based on partition. And the formal end of direct imperial rule didn't necessarily mean the end of informal colonialism, both by former European powers and by the US. One of the most obvious locations for the recent decolonization movement has been South Africa, which is itself still emerging from the ongoing structural and ideological hangover of colonialism and its legacy in the apartheid-based state. It has been within South Africa that a symbolic politics of decolonization has focused on the memorialization of empire and plunder through the Rhodes Must Fall campaign, directed at one of the most obvious individual examples of colonial exploitation, that is, the statue of Cecil Rhodes on the campus of the University of Cape Town, which was removed in 2015 after demonstrations. The targeting of monuments has clear connections with the movement in the US for the removal of statues built as public displays of the Confederacy, that is, the secessionists who fought and lost the US Civil War to preserve the enslavement system. The removal of statues, largely erected long after the end of the Civil War, in places such as New Orleans, Baltimore, and Charlottesville, are not considered to be explicitly decolonizing, However, the backlash against this movement, particularly as expressed in the protests and the violence by white supremacists in Charlottesville, Virginia, in August 2017, are indicative of the highly racialized political processes involved. This does, however, push us to try to highlight exactly what sorts of processes are involved in what comes within the rubric of decolonization. In particular, perhaps, we need to recognize that there are two distinct approaches outlined by the term. These are broadly political decolonization and the decolonization of knowledge. To take the first of these, political decolonization is practical, is pragmatic, and is, of course, political, and is about redressing profound inequalities of history. In this sense, decolonization is about land issues. It's a challenge to the settler colonialism that created much of North America and Australia. It is about recognizing the many forms of indigeneity, not only on the cultural level, but also a more profound sense. In very real terms, as Eve Tuck has said, decolonization is not a metaphor. Such decolonization is a political program that has the potential to challenge and largely transform many of the political, social, and legal assumptions of contemporary Western society. At its most basic level, it's a recognition that the injustices are not only historic, and that there is continuing violence caused by the legacies of colonialism that are most obviously manifest in the Dakota Pipeline, the marginalization of and discrimination against indigenous people, in the need for protests such as Black Lives Matter, in mass incarceration, and much, much more. While some scholars of religion may not necessarily wish to become activists and to try and achieve such social justice, it is still important at a disciplinary, that is, at a structural level, to recognize this gaping wound that festers within today's world. As a discipline that seeks to promote scholarship on a global level, those who study and teach in religious studies need to be aware that this is a challenge, and that silence about it serves particular interests and politics. In short, decolonization isn't simply a matter of words, even though words matter a great deal in what scholars say and what students are taught, as well as also the silences in what is not said and what is not taught in our syllabuses. And this brings me to the second approach, not so much political decolonization, or a not overtly political decolonization, rather a decolonization of knowledge. And my focus here is on this other aspect of decolonization, which can be broadly categorized as a decolonization of culture and knowledge. This is the decolonization that academics are most likely to feel most comfortable with, since it is also about the pursuit of an approach that recognizes and analyzes colonial histories and legacies, and understands that such a history must be challenged. And so, when students ask the question, "Why is my curriculum so white?" it is time to consider what responses we may have within the study of religion. When, in January 2017, there was a request by the Student Union at the School of Oriental and African Studies, that's SOAS in London, to decolonize the philosophy curriculum, the primary issues were that both the content of the syllabus was predominantly white, and that there was no recognition within that curriculum that much of European philosophy is itself a product of colonialism. It doesn't take much effort to discover the racialized assumptions of Kant and other Enlightenment thinkers about non-Europeans and particularly Africans, nor to link that to the brutal European systems of industrialized slavery of that era. Nor does it take much effort to discover that there are powerful traditions of philosophical study within a number of non-European contexts, including China, India, Africa, and Arab and Muslim contexts. Indeed, what we now think of as Western philosophy, and here the prefix Western is usually silent, is born out of Arab-Muslim philosophy as much as, if not more so, than Greek. The convenient exclusion of this legacy is not in any way an accident or omission. It is primarily about the process by which the boundaries of Europe and rational thought have been and are drawn. In response to this, perhaps the discipline of religious studies can feel more comfortable. After all, scholars of Chinese or Indian philosophy are more likely to find homes and careers in religious studies departments than in philosophy ones. On this, since the emergence of religious studies out of divinity and theology, the discipline has been premised on an approach that is global, and so is far less Europe-centered than philosophy. I'd argue, however, that this is a product of the politics of knowledge and disciplinary foundation in the early 20th century. As Gumindra Bambra has argued with respect to the creation of anthropology as a discipline, in contrast to sociology, what's occurring is the writing out of post-colonial non-Western modernities by a Europe-centered modernity. I'll be talking about this in a later podcast. Thus, modern philosophy, sociology, and to a large extent theology, are focused on the modern and the European, whilst disciplines such as anthropology and religious studies focus on the traditional, the pre-modern, and the non-European. That is, although the study of religion serves an important function in exploring and transmitting ancient sources and philosophies from Asia, Africa, and elsewhere, at the same time the discipline does so within a framework of colonially structured modernity. In short, if we teach a course on Asian religions, what is it exactly that we're expected to teach? In most cases, it's likely to be the historical and the textual, the teachings of the Buddha, the Vedas, the rich canon of the classical Chinese philosophical schools deriving from figures such as Kongzi, Confucius, and Lao Tse. If the colonial or the contemporary are included, it's often as an add-on, often presented as an anthropological exploration of the perplexing disparity between the past and the present. My suggestion is that the topic would best be taught from the present backwards, looking at the post-colonial present and how that has been created by the forces of the past. Of these, the legacies of colonialism are the initial framework of how post-colonial realities have come to form, and how these forms have reformed past traditions from long pre-colonial histories. That is not only the scholar and the student who read and understand the classics of China, India, and elsewhere through a lens largely formed through British colonial explorers and writers. So to bring this together, looking at the decolonization of theory and subjects, in addition to all this, there is also the fundamental issue of how scholars of religion think and learn about the tools of scholarship that they use. That is, what is often called, in quotes, theory and methodology. Very often this relies on a set of assumptions and ideas that have not moved very far from the colonial beginnings of the discipline. Thus, one of the most influential textbooks in the discipline is The Overview of Theories of Religion by Daniel Pals. This was originally published in 1996 as 7 theories, but which has developed to its current edition of 9. Of, in fact, the 10 theorists covered, all of them are men. The most recent edition is Clifford Geertz from the 70s and 80s, and they are all racialized as white. Indeed, 7 of these theorists wrote within the colonial era, that is, before 1945. In many respects, the textbooks that are used for undergraduate courses serve very much to define the discipline and its important canon of sources. The ubiquitousness of this book by Pals tells us much more about the discipline than about its author. There is likewise an emerging debate, which has been around since the same time that Pals published his theory book in the mid-1990s, about how to classify and comprehend the global diversity of what we call religions. This is the challenge to the 20th century concept of, quotes, world religions, a typology that classifies differences which is held to be largely self-evident for many scholars, teachers, and students of religion. It's a paradigm with a very definite history, as outlined with meticulous care by Tomoko Masuzawa in her book The Invention of World Religions. And again, this history points us back to the colonial era. The question, of course, is how do we teach the study of religion after world religions, as goes the title of a recent book edited by Cotter and Robertson, in which they explore how to do that. But the challenge goes even further than this. The question is also, how do we decolonize the idea of religion, along with the many structures of thought that come out of and help to sustain this category? One possibility is to take seriously Patrick Wolf's argument that, to quote him, race is colonialism speaking. In which case, there is a need to engage with how the ideas of race and racism are connected, in particular with the idea of religion and religions, as I will be exploring in much more depth in further discussions. So that's all for today. Thanks for listening, and I hope you found the discussion may be provocative, challenging, and also useful and interesting. As I mentioned at the top of the episode, if you'd like to see more details of this podcast and the show notes and so on for this episode, you can find this at the Religion Bytes website. That is one word, religionbytes.xyz, or XYZ if you're American. You'll also find there a link to a written version of this discussion, which is on my Religion Bytes blog on the site medium.com. And if you're listening to this podcast on either iTunes or Stitcher or some other podcast aggregator, then do subscribe and or show you like this episode. These are small things, but they help others to find this. And so, that's it for now. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode. Bye for now.